Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Rick Gray. Today I'll be reading from the May-June edition of Good Old Days magazine. Our first article was submitted by Rosemary O'Grady. It's entitled Wedding Disaster After Disaster. Nothing could keep this marriage from happening. When I was growing up in the 1950s and early 1960s in Niagara Falls, New York, I visited my Aunt Nan and Uncle Carl almost every weekend. That's how I came to meet my future husband, Dennis. His family lived across the street from my aunt and uncle, and he was a frequent visitor there. We went out a few times, and he would meet me at the bus where I was dropped off. Other than that, he pretty much ignored me for the next few years. Still, for my part, I was smitten. Unemployment was rampant in Niagara Falls. I had a brother who lived in Charleston, South Carolina, so in 1963 I left New York. He and his wife let me live with them while I looked for work. When nothing came up by the end of the year, my sister Neen, short for Maureen, came to my rescue. She told me there was a job opening for a key punch operator fairly close to her home in Paterson, New Jersey. So I left Charleston. I was hired the day I arrived in Paterson. 3 months later, I found a better job and rented an apartment close to Neen's. On Valentine's Day, February 14, 1964, flowers were delivered to Neen's house for me. I asked her to open the card. The flowers were from Dennis, and the note said he wanted to see me. Dennis was in the Navy at that time, and we arranged to meet a few weeks later. To my surprise, he asked me to marry him. I guess I wasn't the only one smitten. Of course, I said yes. We decided on March 15, 1965, as the date for our wedding. The invitations had been printed and were ready to be sent. However, a few months before the wedding, Dennis gave me the news that he was being sent to a specialty school from March 1st until the end of June. So then we set a new wedding date for July 3rd. When we were sure of the date, my parents secured the church for us. It was our family church, and five of us, eight siblings, were eventually married there. All of us were married by the same priest. About 3 weeks before the wedding was to take place, I was involved in an automobile accident and ended up in the emergency room for a potentially broken jaw. Luckily, it wasn't broken, but it was very sore. I was advised not to talk. I couldn't anyway because of the pain. I planned to go home to Niagara Falls about 2 weeks before the wedding. My Aunt Jewel gave me a lovely wedding shower the day after I arrived home. While the shower was going on, I walked out to the kitchen to find her and my mom crying. I couldn't imagine why all the tears. It was only a wedding, after all. Then they told me the reason for their tears. Dennis hadn't gotten home to Niagara Falls yet, but he had called his mother to let her know he received orders to report to Naval Station Great Lakes, you guessed it, on July 1st. Mom and Aunt Jewel found out just before the shower was to begin, hence all the tears, but they had carried on with it anyway. Later, Dennis's date to report for duty was changed to July 5th, so then the wedding was still on for July 3rd. My sister, Mary Catherine, was scheduled to graduate from high school that June. She and her boyfriend, Carl, had planned on getting married in August. Due for unforeseen circumstances, that's another story, their wedding had to be moved to a different day. Another wedding had to be planned quickly. Mom insisted we each have our own special day. The only date available that worked for them was Tuesday, June 29, 1965. Her wedding was scaled down because of my plans, although many people who were in town for our wedding were able to attend their wedding as well. Then the fun really began. Dennis had finally arrived home. He wanted me to meet his uncle and aunt. We were invited to have dinner at their farm. The dinner was lovely, and his aunt served homemade Italian wine. I had no idea that drinking that wine would leave me with some very serious side effects. I wasn't drunk, but I was very sick for about 3 days. When I finally recovered, we went back to the farm to help bring in hay. Dennis came down with a grand case of poison oak. This was 12 days before the wedding. Fortunately, there was a military facility nearby, and he was able to go there and get treatment. My sister Sheila was to host our wedding reception at her house, and also was doing the catering. She'd called Mom the day before the wedding with the news that my 5-year-old nephew had come down with chickenpox. After much discussion, it was decided the reception would go on as planned, with some extra help to keep my nephew in isolation. Was this the end of our troubles? Not a chance. On the morning of the wedding, which was scheduled for 10 a.m., Dennis called to tell me his father's car wouldn't start and they wouldn't be able to get to the wedding. His mother was in tears. Dennis suggested to his father that he rent a car, and he said he would pay for it. His father balked at the plan, but he eventually gave in. The car arrived at their house, and they got to the church on time. We all just prayed that nothing else would happen. It was a beautiful day, and the wedding and reception went off without any more problems. We were finally married. We flew back to my apartment in New Jersey for a very brief honeymoon. We have been married 58 years. Would I go through it all again? You bet I would. The next story was sent in by Joanne Burkhart, entitled The Lighter Side of Politics. She voted from her heart for her dad's gift. The small town I grew up in, Penyon, New York, during the 1950s and 60s, had many cute and unique novelty stores. One of my favorites was called Joe Powers. It was full of penny candy and all kinds of interesting tiny toys and knickknacks. I went there a lot during my childhood. It was within walking distance of my house, and I would often take my weekly allowance of 50 cents and load up on penny candy or trinkets that I found there. One day, I'm guessing I was around 8 years old, I had managed to save up my allowance, knowing that my dad's birthday was coming up. I'd seen a cute cigarette lighter there that had caught my eye. I was sure my dad, who was a cigarette smoker, would just love it. It was the kind of lighter they called a table lighter. It was part knick-knack and part useful, the kind you would proudly want to display on your coffee table. At least, that's what I thought. The lighter that had caught my eye was a cute donkey. I believe the reason I was so infatuated with the donkey was because it reminded me of my grandmother's mule, which I loved to ride on at her farm. When I got to the place where the lighters were displayed, I noticed there was a similar lighter that was in the shape of an elephant. When I placed the donkey lighter on the front counter, I told the kind lady at the register about my proud choice for my dad's birthday. She and I had talked many times, and she knew my dad very well. She sort of shook her head in disbelief at my choice and then tried to convince me that I should buy the elephant instead of the donkey. This went back and forth a few times. I kept my heart set on the donkey, which was so cute, and I was bewildered at her constantly saying, "I think your dad would really like the elephant," and "Are you sure he wouldn't want the elephant?" She finally gave up at my insistence that the donkey was cuter. I had no idea why she kept making reference to the elephant. In my mind, the donkey was it. I convinced her at last that it was going to be the donkey. She finally rang it up. Then she gift-wrapped it for me, and I took it home. On the day of my dad's birthday, I excitedly gave him my gift. After opening it, he placed it prominently in one of our living room stands. The thing I did notice, though, I didn't think much of it at the time, was that it eventually ended up in a junk cupboard that my mom had set aside for Dad in the kitchen. It was full of antiques from his mom, some old coins, and bill receipts, odds and ends, and keepsakes my dad wanted to save. It took me years to finally figure this riddle out, but I'm sure probably most anyone reading this can figure out my childhood faux pas right away. The next story was sent in by Frederick J. Amon. It's entitled Returning Home. His walk through the neighborhood, even after 50 years, brought back clear memories of life growing up. I grew up on Long Island in the village of Valley Stream from elementary through high school. After college, I left to get married and raise my family. I recently returned to my old hometown. Not counting visits to my mom, who moved shortly after I headed out, it was my first time back in 50 years. During those formative times, I knew every inch of the neighborhood. There were 48 stops on my paper route, and I knew how many cracks there were in the sidewalk on the way to the house of my best friend Louie, who lived just around the corner from me. There were 30 yards between the telephone poles that marked our touch football field boundaries. Our games were often paused to allow traffic to pass. The tree that marked home base for hide-and-seek and Ringo Levio, a game of New York origin that involves two teams, hunters and prey, was surprisingly still there and even more massive, its branches spreading further skyward. My house was a small two-story cape with a stoop leading onto a tiny front porch and a mailbox slot in the door. The lawn was no bigger than a 10-minute effort with an old-fashioned push mower. Standing in front of the house at 72 Liberty, I could envision my grandmother keeping watch from her upstairs window. I visited the local playground, my Field of Dreams, where I played out World Series games and NFL championships with my friends, constantly fighting among us to see who would be the Yankees or football Giants. Somehow, I remembered Clearstream Elementary to be much larger. I spent my allowance on candy bars, baseball cards, and soda pop at Conti's Candy Store and Lou's Log Cabin on Merrick Road. I was a Yoo-Hoo guy, and returning enough bottles for the 2-cent deposit would pay for another. Gus's Pizza offered 2 slices and a Coke for a quarter. All my old haunts had been replaced with car dealerships and tax services. Even Nick's Barbershop, where my hair was kept in style from buzz cut through Beatles mop top to hippie chic, was now part of Safeguard self-storage that stretched an entire block. The Rockfront Tavern, the corner bar my father owned, was long gone in favor of an overflow parking lot for Mazda of Valley Stream. I can still picture the old man behind the bar, cigarette butt dangling from the corner of his mouth, apron tied at the waist, pouring a tall one from the Schaefer tap. A box of Slim Jims, always positioned to the back wall, next to the Wise potato chips and bottles of Seagram's and Johnny Walker Red, was my reward for helping him stock the shelves. I can still remember the taste of them to this day. I walked the 2 miles to Memorial Junior High and, like a homing pigeon, returned to the route. I successfully found every turn along the way. It did take me a bit longer than in 1964. Although I earned less than stellar grades, I competed well in wrestling and track. With minor detours, it was also the same way to Blessed Sacrament Church and Sunday Mass. I would spend just enough time inside the chapel to walk in one door and sneak out the other, avoiding the nuns and grabbing a weekly bulletin as proof of attendance. If my mom questioned me on the sermon topic, I knew I could not go wrong with some variation of God loves you. Although the landscape had changed during my half-century absence, I discovered many memories were set in stone, maybe slightly altered by a youthful view. Regardless of where we currently reside, returning to that one place that will forever be home brings back the recollections of those wonderful years. The next story was sent in by Arlene Chauvald. It's entitled No Mushy Cards for My Mom. Hers is a caring heart even after 100 years. Finding a Mother's Day card for my mom, Dorothy Maelstrom, was always difficult. I would venture to say about 98% of the cards I found at the store were sweet and sentimental and not at all what my mother would have appreciated. Born at home in the country in 1916 to my Irish grandmother when Grandma was 42 years old, my mom was the last of six children, one of whom died at age 3 of spinal meningitis. So Grandma, like many women of her time, learned to take her licks and not complain, even though her heart was breaking. My mother followed suit. In 1937, she married my dad, who was also the youngest of six. He had been orphaned at age 4 and was raised by an equally tough, no-nonsense Swedish aunt. So feelings were just not expressed in our Irish and Scandinavian family, even though the love and caring were always apparent. Feelings when I was growing up in the 1940s and 50s in Michigan's Upper Peninsula were not talked about or expressed unless your family was Italian, and ours wasn't. If there was a falling out among family members or friends, frequently it was never resolved. That relationship was over. You can see how buying a Mother's Day card for my mom was quite a task. Most spoke of what a wonderful, sweet, kind, loving, and caring mother she was. Those sentiments just would not have been appreciated. In fact, Mom stated more than once that she did not like mushy cards, so I had to look for funny ones. What she did love, however, were the simple, handmade gifts I gave her when I was growing up. Pictures I drew, a violet I had dug up and replanted in a soup can, and as I grew older, aprons on tea towels that I had sewn. Once I made her a fancy negligee, but like most of the new things she received, it was saved for best and never worn. While other mothers received perfume and complete new outfits from a local style shop, my mother was happy with simple things, like a handkerchief or a box of cherry chocolates, as long as they weren't accompanied by a mushy card. Finding a non-mushy card was hard, so sometimes I just gave up and made my own. It was a strange time for sure. Discussing feelings or giving a card that expressed them was about as off-limits as talking about sex. But I did my best, and I do think my attempts at Mother's Day gifts and cards were appreciated, even though she didn't respond with a mushy hug and kiss. Apparently, that staunch, no-nonsense attitude served her well. At present, she is 107 years old, living in a nursing home and doing fairly well. On her 107th birthday, she made national news, but not wanting to call attention to herself, she refused to speak to the interviewers. It was my sister who told about her life and how she had lived through the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, the Depression, World War II and Korea, and survived having my brother, her son, sent to Vietnam, something she had always dreaded since having a baby boy in 1944. He and my sister, who still lived in Upper Michigan, helped her remain at home until she was 103. After his death in 2019, still tough as nails, she decided it was time to go into a nursing home. To this day, I don't send her mushy cards. She would be insulted. But beneath the tough shell, there remains a kind and caring heart, and I still send her cards every week from my home in Colorado, just not the mushy kind. The next story was sent in by Pat Cochran. It's entitled 65 Years of Wedded Blessings. Their faith took them across the world and back. Joanne and I met back in 1958. When I was in the Air Force stationed at Castle Air Force Base in Merced, California. I would drive down to my home in San Diego every few weeks to visit my family in Ocean Beach. During one of my visits, a neighbor girl who lives several houses down the street dropped by to visit my sister while I was trying out a hula hoop. She had long black hair and a nice figure, and I wondered if she would go out with me on a date. Well, the short of the story is that she accepted, which resulted in a 10-month relationship that grew during my visits to San Diego. In 1959, I asked her to marry me. We were wed just before I left the Air Force, and we moved back to San Diego. Realizing that I needed an education, I began classes at San Diego State College with an industrial arts education major. The next 4 years were lean ones, as I worked nights at a local bank and went to school during the day. Joanne took in foster kids to supplement our income. I remember one time having to borrow 10 cents to buy a cup of coffee. Well, I finally graduated, but instead of a teaching position, I interviewed for a sales job with the Charles A. Bennett Company, specializing in industrial arts and home economics school textbooks. They provided me with a new Buick car every 2 years and a monthly expense account. My area of sales was California, Arizona, and New Mexico. I would travel to the various school districts, and the company flew me home every weekend in order to be with my family. So we had the best that life could offer, right? But not long after Joanne and I joined a wonderful church in our West Covina, California neighborhood, I realized that God wanted me to step out in faith and serve Him in the mission field. Long story short, we joined Wycliffe Bible Translators in 1967, attended jungle camp in Mexico, and were assigned to the Philippines as children's home parents. After 20 years in the Philippines, where both of us worked in many different roles, we were assigned back to the United States. We served at the JAARS, Jungle Aviation and Research Service Center, and Waxhaw, North Carolina, for the next 30 years. The next story was sent in by Linda Pelfrey, entitled Love Some Ramps, a delicacy to some could chase others away. Ramps are also known as ramson, wild leek, and wild garlic. They are a North American species of wild onion or garlic, and are regarded as an early spring vegetable and have a pungent garlic-like odor and a very pronounced onion flavor. In Appalachia, ramps are most commonly prepared with potatoes fried in bacon fat. They can also be pickled or used in soups, beans, and scrambled eggs. The year was 1928. My dad, Quentin, was 10 years old. Early spring had arrived in West Virginia, and he was so excited to go up in the mountains to search for one of his favorite foods, ramps. He arose early and took off with his best friend. They searched for hours until finally they found the biggest cluster of ramps they had ever seen. Both boys filled their sacks with this delicacy. Quentin took his home and proudly handed the sack to his mom, hoping she'd fry some with potatoes for their dinner that evening. Now, Quentin and his mom were the only ones in their big family who would eat ramps, because even though they tasted good, they caused the ramp eater to reek something awful for a few days. Think garlic and triple the smell of a person's breath who had eaten it. The odor after partaking of a mess of ramps would come not only from their breath, but also from their pores, offending the noses of anyone within close proximity. Nevertheless, for dinner that evening, Quentin and his mom ate more than their fair share of potatoes fried with ramps. After that dinner, the rest of the family kept their distance so they wouldn't smell the awful odor coming from them. Quentin shared a room with his older brother, Woody. Woody tried to go to sleep that night, but he was feeling sick from the strong aroma coming from Quentin. Woody got the idea that he'd push his bed next to the window, put a pillow on the windowsill, and fall asleep with his head hanging out the window. His plan worked well, except that the window wouldn't open all the way, so it stayed gently perched on Woody's head. Still, he fell into a blissful sleep without the stench of ramps. My grandfather, Wood, was a railroad engineer, and he was just getting home from work late that night. He pulled up beside the house, and the first thing he saw was Woody's head hanging out the window, with the top window seeming to have him pinned. Wood went running into the house, thinking his son was injured. He got to the bedroom and turned on the light, waking both boys. Woody pulled in his head from the window and, holding his nose, explained to his dad that Quentin ate a mess of ramps. At about the same time as Woody's proclamation, Wood caught a whiff of that strong ramp odor. Trying not to gag, he told Woody to go sleep on the sofa. He then closed the bedroom door to trap the ramp odor in there. A few minutes later, Wood came downstairs in his pajamas and robe and told Woody to move over and make room for him. He had gone upstairs to go to bed, only to discover that his wife had also eaten a bunch of ramps. Wood and Woody had to share a couch while Quentin and his mom slept comfortably in their own beds. The next story was sent in by Clyde Baird. It started with a paddle ball. On cold, gray Saturdays when I was 11 years old, I often would go to the local picture show at the local theater. The movies were always cowboy shows, and you could pay for a ticket and stay to watch it over and over. Well, on one particular Saturday, I went up to the balcony and found my seat as usual. As I was enjoying the show, I was suddenly hit in the back of my head by something. I looked around but was unable to determine what or who had done this. I returned to watching the show, and after a few minutes, I was struck again in the back of my head. I turned again to look behind me, and two rows back was this young girl. I went back to where she was, and wouldn't you know it, there was an empty seat beside her. I sat down and saw, in the low light of the theater, that she had a paddle ball in her hand. We talked softly, and as my eyes adjusted, I could see this girl was a beautiful blonde. She told me her name was Barbara, and she too was 11. By that time, my heart had begun to race. When the show ended, I asked her if I could sit with her next Saturday. She said yes, and I think we sat in the same seats as the week before. I could see her more clearly then, and I didn't know it at the time, but my life would never be the same. She truly was the girl of my dreams. We did everything together. We were married after we graduated high school in June 1953. In the years following, we were blessed with four wonderful children, two boys and two girls. We were married for over 60 years. And just to think, it all started when I was hit in the back of my head by a paddle ball by that beautiful 11-year-old girl. And the next story was sent in by Marilyn Nixick. Not just luck. In the 1940s and 50s, most writing contests were the 25 words or less kind of competition, and my mother was very good at winning them. She was a little girl in Kenosha, Wisconsin, when she entered a jingle contest and won her very first prize of two pencils along with a congratulatory letter. From then on, she would enter any contest she could find. She even subscribed to a monthly newsletter devoted to notifying contest lovers of the latest competitions. Sweepstakes eventually became more popular over the years. The cost of stamps was much lower, and rules allowed for multiple entries, so Mom would ask for my help. I made her dozens of 3x5-inch cards with her name and address on them. My mother was very successful with her hobby over her lifetime and won many prizes. The biggest prize was a new car, but there were many others. When she won a year's supply of groceries, my father bought me a new Tiny Tears doll to celebrate. Later on, I was happy to have a new bike thanks to her efforts. My brother and his wife had fun choosing from the collection of kitchen appliances she won. My favorite memory was of a giant box being delivered to our home. It was filled with toys, which included a Sneaky Pete's Magic Show set and a Betsy McCall doll. There was a bit of excitement every day because we never knew if the mail would announce that my mother had won a new prize. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the May-June edition of Good Old Days Magazine. I'm Rick Gray. So long until next time.